I get the privilege and the honor to introduce George, who's leading the meeting. I guess I'll do the traditional how I met the speaker thing. I was involved in regional service in Louisiana in about 1985, 86, 87, and we had I think around 1986, had some problems in the region, and we voted to call the World Service Office and ask for some members of World Services to come and help us get a handle on kind of some growing pains we were having in the region. And they sent a few members of World Services to come and share with us and to give their experience, strength, and hope, and to instruct us a bit. And George was one of the folks that came down, and I remember real clearly he did put up a blackboard, and he did like the service structure of NA and lined it out for us and gave us a real clear picture of you know, what NA is and how it works and how it's all put together and how it flows. And it was real helpful for us. And I know that, you know, the big thing is we came out of that weekend with a resolution to the problems in the region. And, you know, the problems that we were having got taken care of. And, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, we get the help we need and we never have to face the problems alone, you know, just like we do in recovery. I've also been privileged to learn from George in recovery. I was privileged to work for George. He was my boss for a couple of years. He's the director at the World Service Office, and I've got just a world of respect and admiration for this man. So I feel honored to be here and be able to introduce him. George?
Hi, everybody. My name's George. I'm an addict. First of all, I'd like to tell you that this is the first ever workshop of this kind put on by World Services. And it really came about through the efforts of members in this region who contacted the World Service Office and the World Board asking for this type of workshop for this convention. And it was really through their efforts that we were able to put this together and hopefully give you a sense of what this fellowship has gone through and what we and the members before us have gone through to try and make sure that this fellowship was here when you and I got here. First of all, I'll tell you, I'm not a history expert. I don't know every last thing about history. I do have a pretty good idea overall of now how this fellowship started. For many, many years, the archives of Narcotics Anonymous really have existed in the hands of individuals, and only of late have we been able to obtain some of that information from those individuals to create an overall fellowship archives at the World Service Office. And it's a great privilege to be able to be a custodian of this material at the office. I'm going to do something, and since this is the first time, we're going to find out whether or not it works. I have a tape that was in those archives that is a tape of Jimmy Kinnon. And Jimmy Kinnon was probably the person most closely related to being, quote-unquote, a founder of Narcotics Anonymous. But Jimmy always maintained that he was not a founder, that he was one of several people who got together who helped create the fellowship that we know today as Narcotics Anonymous. And Jimmy insisted on that. Well, I will tell you that from the information that we have now and the information that we've been able to put together, Jimmy Kinnon was the most consistent individual involved with the beginning in the history of Narcotics Anonymous. He was there when it started, he was there in the 60s when it restarted, and he was there all the way up until he passed in 1985. And much of what we know about Narcotics Anonymous' beginnings comes from Jimmy, because Jimmy was one of the only people who kept records. And he used to show up at meetings with tape machines, and there's about 300 to 350 reel-to-reel tapes at the WSO that have to be gone through. And each one of them, I'll tell you, I've been privileged to listen to a number of them, tell a story, and tell the story of Narcotics Anonymous and how we began. Before I put on the tape, let me set the scene for you. The year is 1947. Lexington, Kentucky, in the U.S. Public Health Hospital for addicts, which at the time was the only known treatment for narcotics addicts that existed in the United States. There was also a public health treatment facility later on in Fort Worth. But in Lexington, a gentleman who came from Louisiana showed up, got moved, his job changed, and he showed up at Lexington. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and his name was Houston. And he used to go into the public hospital, and he used to talk to the doctor, Dr. Vogel. And he would talk about how they could somehow take these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and create something that would work for the addicts who were there. Once you signed up at Lexington, you were there for the full term. Otherwise, you faced criminal charges. So it wasn't really a volunteer place, although people would show up there by their own free choice. But once they showed up and signed all the mountains of paperwork, they were there. And they got whatever kind of experimental treatment happened to be going on at the time. Well, what they ended up creating was something called the Narco Group. And the Narco Group was the first group of addicts, and although the hospital was involved with them quite a bit, it was the first group of addicts who started to sit down and started to meet together and talk about recovery. They met with very little success because the meetings pretty much stayed inside the hospital. But there was one gentleman who, after going to Lexington some 8 or 9 times, decided to try and take this out of the hospital, and he started meetings back in 1951 in New York City. His name was Danny Carlson. What we know now is that Narcotics Anonymous, as it was called, was more of a social agency. You know, you showed up at Narcotics Anonymous meetings at the Salvation Army in New York City, and they would do things like make sure you got a job. They would do things like put you on your feet and put you up. And what the tape is going to tell you is a little bit about Jimmy's contact with Danny Carlson in New York and talking about what Danny was trying to do. Because Jimmy found himself, he walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous in February of 1950. And he found himself getting in trouble because as he was making coffee and becoming more responsible for finding people for the meeting, as he said, as you'll hear him say on the tape, the first few speakers that he got were all addicts. And the people that he seemed to have a closer bond to were drug addicts who were showing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, they didn't know it because those of us who had experience in going to Alcoholics Anonymous when we came into the program know that sometimes that they were less than welcome. And I don't blame them, really. They should have been less than welcome. But nobody talked about drugs. You know, nobody talked about that type of thing back in 1950, 1951, even though they happened to be in California. California was a growing fellowship. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous had just adopted the 12 traditions. So the 12 traditions were virtually new. And not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous grabbed onto the traditions and saw them as a wonderful thing. And it took them a while to be able to use it. But it was Jimmy's thought from the very beginning that the 12 traditions were integral to what in setting up a fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous and actually starting the meeting. And that was a point that he consistently made all of the time. That the problem with the other movements that started outside of Southern California was they didn't use the traditions. And you'll hear him say that. Now, in the tape begins with a discussion with Jimmy and Gene Haig. Gene Haig is a member who came in the early 1960s who's still clean today. He lives in Oregon. If anybody has had any contact with Jimmy Kennan, you'll know that when you started Jimmy talking, you could go down just about any subject that happened to come through Jimmy's mind at the time, even though you were trying to ask him a specific question. And that's just the way Jimmy was. He was a storyteller. And he had a great amount of information to share with people about the program and about recovery and about starting groups and about starting meetings. Those of us who were not fortunate enough to get clean in Southern California usually found Jimmy on the other end of the telephone when we called, when we found out there really was a World Service office. We found Jimmy on the other end of the line. So we're starting off now. These two gentlemen are sitting in Jimmy's living room. And the tape recorder goes on. And usually once the tape recorder goes on, Jimmy never turned it off. Okay? So you're going to hear things like bird sounds, because Jimmy had some parakeets in the living room. You're going to hear the phone ring. Jimmy's going to get up and answer it. And the first discussion that they're talking about is a letter that Jimmy received back in 1960 from a group of physicians in Australia. And he's going to talk about communicating with them. Now, he's going to talk about that for a while on the tape, and then the phone's going to ring. And finally, he turns off the tape when the phone rings, and then Gene gets him back into talking about how the fellowship starts. The tape's about 40 minutes, and it's a terrific story, and you get some good information. Rather than me sitting up here telling you the information that I obtained from him, I thought it would be best for you to hear it directly from one of the members who happened to be there. So it'll last 40 minutes, and I'll come back up and take the story through the next 20 years.
This little booklet here from Sydney.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. You know, I remember in 1962 when we were communicating with those people over there.
Right. And I sent them the first tape in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was never going to get a reply, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe it got lost in the mail, you know, which could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I get a letter, you know. And I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I probably have it written down someplace in some of my old stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I get a letter, and he said, sorry to be, you know, so long in answering,
mm-hmm.
but so we've been having a very rough time trying to get going again, you know, get started. See, I talked to him before that, and he got a couple of groups started. And I said,
mm-hmm.
I'll send you down a tape to some of the people, you know.
Uh-huh.
So I sent down a tape with little excerpts from who the hell was that?
Was that a Thursday night down at Yakim Dallas?
No, that was the original meeting place over in at Rhodes and Moore Park, the church.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
It was a Unity church at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's now Unitarian.
Mm-hmm.
And so. We didn't get to Yuck and Gar for a long, long time. Really, quite a while.
Was that in 61
or 62? 61, I sent the first tapes mm-hmm. down. So I'd been in touch with them before that. See?
Yeah.
I'd been in touch with them probably the end of 60, the beginning of 61,
mm-hmm.
By letter, you know. And they said they were having a hell of a time trying to get started. But they didn't like the name, you know, Narcotics Anonymous. And they were afraid that the cops were going to bother them. I told them the same thing. We'd still tell them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're still telling them. Anyway, go to your narcotic division if you have one. Go to the police department. Go to the sheriff. Go to the marshal and tell them what you're trying to tell. Hey, I'm clean. I'm not in any trouble. This is what we're trying to do. You know,
mm-hmm.
Don't go down and ask them because they'll say no.
Yeah.
Go down and tell them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they got one meeting underway, and they were having a hell of a time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a couple of letters. So then I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. It might be helpful. I had just gotten one of my old tape recorders, the old 7-inch reel, you know.
That's the one I got,
that old Silvertone.
Yeah.
I just got that first.
I still got that. I never
made
that away.
So that was one, if you remember when you said, geez, I'd like to buy that, and I said,
mm-hmm.
I hate my hell to give it up.
Mm-hmm.
That was the reason.
I
hate to give it up.
Well, I'll never give it up.
Yeah, because it was the first one. So I got that, and I did.
That's a real keepsake, Jimmy.
Yeah, and it was something that I hadn't, I wasn't too familiar with. I didn't know anything about electronics. And there was so much noise. We didn't have good microphones, you know, the whole stuff. But we made some tapes, and then I took them here and went through them and took pieces out and put it on another, and that's when I went down and got another machine. I bought the old Wallensack.
Wallensack, yeah. And then you bought two of them.
So then I used that, and then later on I bought another Wallensack so I could match them up. And then I would take the Silvertone, and Silvertone was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Silvertone.
And then
I would run off what I wanted to on a new tape. So that I made, that's when I started to make tapes. And later on, I sent some of the same tapes out to some of the other prisons around the country here and up in Canada. Some of the first tapes that went up to Canada, in fact, were the same tapes. And I've still got some of them, the old boxes that went out and came back. And so, so when I sent that down, then I sent a letter with it, of course, and if possible, if anybody's got a tape recorder down there, and you get around to it, make a tape of whoever was there, you know, and...
send it back.
And send it back to us, you know. And so they sent back the one... They sent back the one I had sent down, I believe. I think they sent it back. And I told them to keep it if they wanted to, but they sent it back. And then a while later, I get the tape. If you remember right, if you happened to be at that meeting at the church, when I got it back, or maybe you were just starting at that time, when I got it back, I took it down, and we played it at the meeting.
See? Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, we played it at the meeting. It was kind of hard to understand because of the their accents, too, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know whether you remember, there's a little fighter on there that gave quite a good pitch. And I'm going to have to look that. I have that tape around here. I started looking for it, but I got a lot of stuff in boxes. And the way I've been feeling the last year and a half, I haven't felt really like getting into anything.
You're digging into that.
You know, I've neglected everything. My front yard looks like hell the last... Well, since the middle of January, this has been going on. You know, no time to do anything. Much.
Yeah.
But then we kept in touch, and then they died out.
That must have been about the mid-60s or something, huh? 65,
they died out
66.
About a year after that.
Yeah.
And then I wrote, got no answers.
So it was mainly, wasn't it mainly nurses and doctors, medical
it was
people?
Mainly, yeah. Mainly all, like, nurses, doctors, dentists, any professional people. And the others were just lucky if you caught somebody who wasn't professional.
Yeah.
They were all in what they call the registry. They were all like, the registry there is like the AMA here.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were all in the registry. They were afraid of losing the registration, actually.
Sure.
So that's what made it very difficult, because the other people were... most of these people were using probably morphine, Demerol, morphine, and so forth, the legit drug, you know. And well, some of them were using heroin. It was not as widespread as you might think, you know. But they were using heroin. So you had a very limited number of people who were willing to admit that they had a problem and were afraid. And the others... You know, the pillhead, the average run-of-the-mill addict, he wasn't getting any help at all anywhere.
Yeah.
He didn't even recognize them.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? And so, they died out three or four times. In fact, this time that they're starting in again, really. I go through the whole story with the evidence to show why these things happen. Just a few years back, the same thing again. They started a sort of a revival, a renewed interest in N.A. And then they did exactly what we talk about so often. They got away from the tradition. They started to use the N.A. name in other places. They started to finagle around with the program. And every time that we do those kind of things, we kill ourselves. We destroy ourselves. And this has happened. We've seen it here. We've seen it in other parts of this country. We saw it in Canada. We've seen it now in Australia. But this time it seems like they finally got their feet on the ground and are willing to live by the tradition as groups. Get together. Now they've got a couple of good years behind them now. They're beginning to really grow again, grow well. And I told them, these kids were talking to us, I said, oh, I'm so interested all the time. I said, so please send me, sit down with the group or your region or your area. sit down and make a tape. Let us know what's going on. If you have any problems, if you want to talk about anything, tell us. If you've got any good news for us, tell us.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got anything you think would help us, let us know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and I'll get a couple of people around the table in my house here, and we'll answer the tape. So mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago, I talked to a couple of people. And maybe in about another week, see how I feel. Maybe about another week, I'll get together, and we're going to make a tape to set down.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. And that way, then they won't forget.
Yeah.
I get them going again, like I usually do.
That's right.
See? Yeah. And I'll send them down a tape with a few people. I've got some stuff that I got on a videotape, and I can take the audio off the videotape and send
some. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So, and that, because that would be good, I had Bill, you know, from Cry, and I had a couple of guys from San Gabriel Valley, and one of them, two of them took their cakes tonight. We just had, automatically, they were going to come over, they were going to go someplace, they run into some of the people who were coming here.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, you know, we should come on over here, come on with us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, be all right. Said, sure, be all right. Well, we've never been there, you know.
Uh-huh.
So he went out and he bought a cake on the way over because he knew that both of these guys had birthdays.
Oh,
one had his birthday that day and one had it a couple of days earlier.
Fire.
So we gave him the cake right here in the house. So it was good.
See, that was nice, yeah.
And we sat here for about 2 hours and made a cake.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take some of that audio off and maybe send it down to Australia. That might be something that'll start another little exchange of program.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know how I am right now. I've always been that way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are, in some ways, are very much alike, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about it before.
Yeah.
So we're both hardheads, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We make up our minds as the way we're going to do things. We try our goddamnedest to make it work.
You know? That's right.
And then if we see there's something wrong, then we'll think it over.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll change and we'll try something else.
Mm-hmm.
God damn it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember years ago, I don't know if I ever told you this or not, but years ago, when Les, you know, Les was...
Les Frost?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Les came to me one day and he said, I like that kid. He said, a goddamn friend of yours. He said, but he thinks he can get me so goddamn mad. You know, I get... Well, you know, he's not a Muffy's temper. He's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know? For me, I'd blow up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd blow up two times, you know.
Sure.
And he said, you know, such a nice kid. He said, God damn, he's a hard-headed son of a bitch, isn't he? I said, yeah, he sure is.
Yeah, that's right.
I said, he's just like I am. Yeah, he is. That's true. And he said, well, you get mad quicker than he does. I said, oh, yeah? I said, you don't know Gene. You know.
And I said, you got to push the right button.
Yeah. I said, you don't know Gene. I said, we go at it sometimes. I said, but I want to tell you something about Gene. And I said, I think it's true about me, too.
Mm-hmm.
I said, when I think something's right, I give it everything I got, and I stand up, and I'll be counted, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I said, but goddamn, if I found out I'm wrong,
uh-huh.
I'll take my tenth step,
mm-hmm.
and I'll
stand right up and, sure,
and admit it.
Stand right up and tell me wrong.
And I said, you'll find out mm-hmm. Gene's exactly the same way. If he feels mm-hmm. that he's wrong in anything he's said or done to you,
mm-hmm.
he'll come over and he'll tell you.
That's
you
right.
Know? And he said, that's good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Should I kick this thing off, Jimmy?
No, I don't care.
Okay.
Just hit that second button from the far end.
Okay.
Hello?
Okay, see if I can remember where we were. Anyway, it does look like we're really getting going now that we've got your region.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a couple of good get-togethers,
mm-hmm.
social gatherings, you know. I think last year they had their first real good get-together at the convention. And they have another one coming up. I think it's next month, or this month, or September. Probably towards the end of this coming month.
Mm-hmm.
Or September, early September. So they seem to be doing well. They're beginning to get along a lot better with
mm-hmm.
each other.
Yeah.
We've got the people that were trying to use the program
mm-hmm.
now out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, that's what happens. But,
hey, Jimmy, you know what I'd like to do? Is I know we've talked about this a lot of times, but my memory is so bad, you know, about exactly what happened in the beginning when the program first was developed, you know, and who was involved and like where the meeting was. And,
yeah, well, and, that goes back to right to here at the house. You know.
Yeah.
We had talked, different people had talked. And like I told you, it seemed like in the beginning, I knew something seemed to be missing with me.
Mm-hmm.
I was no great big into heavy drug addiction, you know, mm-hmm. per se.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in such bad shape that that I couldn't go no further, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Pills were enough, along with the booze and the pills and mm-hmm. the other crap.
Mm-hmm.
Was enough for me. I didn't need no heroin, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was in such goddamn bad shape then. Shot of heroin would have killed me right then
yeah.
and there, you know.
Yeah.
I could hardly work, you know. If I worked a couple hours a day, I was lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And see, one of my biggest defects of character that I talk about once in a while is I'm so goddamn responsible.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the things that I have to be very careful about, being responsible.
Yeah, too responsible.
Overly responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a killer for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could never say screw everything and walk off.
And you let it go.
It's
yeah.
like you're trying that control.
Uh-huh.
And control will kill you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, but I had gone as far as I could go, you know,
mm-hmm.
and there was no place further I could go.
Yeah.
So when I came on the program, of course, it was AA, there was no one there.
Yeah. Did you come in at the North Hollywood Club?
I came in at North Hollywood in 1951, and I was in bad shape. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Some of these people come on
what
stand.
What month was that?
That was 1950.
50?
Yeah.
What month?
February.
February.
February 1950.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it was Groundhog Day.
Huh.
And so I was so goddamn bad shape, you know, that I couldn't absorb anything. I couldn't talk.
Mm-hmm.
I looked like hell, you know. I looked like mm-hmm. death warmed over.
Mm-hmm.
And people used to look at me and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Someone used to look at me and they were afraid to talk to me because I was wild. You know?
Yeah.
And then I was so almost totally deaf, you know. I couldn't hear.
Mm-hmm.
My hearing was pretty bad. And but I kept going back down there, you know. I kept trying to listen. So mostly I had to read, you know. My
mm-hmm.
sponsor wouldn't give me loan me his book. It took me about 3.5 months until I had $350
to buy a book.
I could spend to buy a book.
Yeah.
I still got it. That's right over there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so long as I got a little bit better, you know, my head began to get a little unscrambled.
Mm-hmm.
I began to meet people. I didn't attach myself to too many people. I just couldn't seem to cotton to them too much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I understood what they were saying, and I could relate to what they were saying. But it still seemed to be something a little missing, you know.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I started to make a couple of friends, new friends, you know.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, I found out about a year later, all these guys were addicts.
Huh, interesting, huh?
Really funny, you know.
Yeah. Who was that, like Gil Van Hansen?
Pat Han. This was before Gil even came around.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't around 19... I think Gil came around about 52. 52, I think Gil started.
Yeah, I think so. Because
he didn't have a year when we started the habit-forming drugs group, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But he used to come downtown with us to the AA meetings down in Skid Row, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so Gil and his wife and Eddie and his
Eddie
wife.
Eddie Cochran?
Yeah, Eddie and his wife.
And Pat Han.
And Pat Han. And these people were always on my ass. Why don't you start something? Why don't you do something for the addicts, you know? Because I'd been in touch, I think, in 1951 or 52, I think I got in touch with Danny Carlson, who formed the original kind of NA, not the kind as we know it. They didn't have steps like we've got today. They didn't have mm-hmm. steps like we have, you know.
Mm-hmm. Who was that, Danny Carlson?
That Danny Carlson.
Oh, Danny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Danny was in Lexington, and he had gone to some AA meetings, and he got much the same idea, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then they developed that to a point where what they differed from us, and what I didn't like was that, of course, when I wrote to Danny, there was no group. There wasn't even a group except what they would get together and hold a group. There was nothing standard.
Yeah.
There was no ongoing group.
Uh-huh.
And then I lost the letter and the other information I got from Danny. And I was talking to a friend of mine one day, and I said, I'm going to have to write to him again. She says, I just wrote to him.
Mm-hmm.
I think I gave her his address when she got it someplace. And she said, I just wrote to him, and I got a letter back from him.
Who was that wrote to her?
Danny Carlson.
No, I mean, who was the lady that wrote to her?
Dorothy Sullivan.
Oh, Dorothy.
Yeah, Dorothy, you remember. Dorothy. So she said, I'll give you the letter, you know. She said, I just wrote to him just because we had been talking, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I wrote to him and to find out what he's doing. So I got the letter and the other stuff. I only have the letter left.
You see, what they did, they were looking for people to sponsor addicts, take care of them, to try to get them trained to get a job, to try to find a place for them to stay, to try to get them medical help, to try to get them education of any kind, you know, to help to educate them. And, you know, this is not the way that we look at things.
No.
They were more like the outreach program.
Social work.
Got.
Yeah.
More in the line of the social activities, you see. And this is what they were trying to do up in New York, trying to set it up. And they were not anonymous. They would go on radio, you know.
Yeah.
They would go on radio at that time.
Now, that was from Lexington. They went up to New York.
Well, Danny was from New York.
Yeah.
I believe Danny was originally from New York.
So when he got out, he went to New York.
Yeah, but Danny was very ill. He had cancer.
Oh, yeah. What did they call that?
They called it N.A.
Oh, N.A.
It was called N.A. That's where we got the name from. That's the only thing we got from them was the name.
Huh.
Because it made sense to me to use the name Narcotics Anonymous because most of the stuff people were using at that time were all downers in one form or another, from heroin on down, or up, whichever way you want to look at it. There wasn't much coke going on at that time, you know. There wasn't much... weren't too many professionals who were willing to admit they were addicts, as you know, in this country. They tried to take care of their own, and of course a lot of them didn't make it, as we know.
Yeah.
You know, I know doctors that died and nurses, and many friends of mine died years ago. And they just couldn't make it. They couldn't get off the goddamn pills, you know. So, and I still say, you've heard me say it, still the biggest killer in the world is a combination of booze and pills. It'll kill more people than anyone ever thought of killing.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
You know that from your own story.
Sure.
You know? And, they would always get on my case. Well, you start. You get a place and we'll have a meeting. You know, I said, what else are you guys getting a meeting? You know? And I began to get to know a few more people. So I used to go downtown with Eddie. And, of course, I knew Cy from the group. But Cy used to make the statement, something that once in a while you get up on the podium down at the group and say, oh, let these addicts and these other people find another place to go. AA is for alcoholics, and that's what it is. You know? So he was hard-nosed that way, but Cy was a hard-nosed, let's face it. And a lot like ourselves. He was going to do things his way, goddammit, you know, whether anybody liked it or not. And he wouldn't listen to anybody. We'd listen to each. Sometimes we'd listen to each other, you know, or we'd listen to the program, and so I thought about it, and I thought, I ain't up to doing that. Gee, I'm not physically up to it, you know. I wasn't working 4 hours a day yet, you know, and half the time I couldn't get a job. There was only one guy would hire me at that time, as a matter of fact. I couldn't find a job.
You were painting then?
No, I was roofing.
Oh, roofing.
And that's hard work, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And so anyway, we got along for a while. One Thursday night, I think it was about the second or third month of 1953. I go down, and I'm making the coffee down there, as I usually did. I made coffee down there for years.
North Island
Clubhouse. That's where I met you.
Yeah.
I was making coffee the night I met you down there. I was making coffee at that time for the clubhouse.
Oh, yeah.
When I met you.
Yeah.
I don't mean I was making coffee that day.
At that particular time, yeah.
But that was one of my jobs down there, was making coffee.
Oh, yeah. Because Paul called you.
Paul called me. He called me here at the house. And I said, "Hell, I'll come right now."
Yeah, and you know, when you come in, it was I felt like I was being tested. You know, if I could be accepted or something. Yeah. I said, "Geez, boy."
Well, he said to me,
"Jimmy,
I think I got a live one here, and I'm not quite sure how to handle it. You come down." I said, "Hell yeah." I didn't know any more than he did about anything, you know. There was a little bit of gave him a little bit of courage, and gave me a little bit of courage too.
Yeah.
And when I saw you, I had that feeling that you were ready, you know. I don't think I had to say much of anything. In fact, I don't think I did say much of anything.
I think what you said is, he can be part of our group or something,
right,
you know. It was like he gave you approval that I could join your group.
That's what you want, you know.
Yeah,
that was one of the things I had to contend with. That I used to burn me. I used to stay away from groups sometimes. They'd look to me for approval, and I used to try to tell them, I ain't got nothing more to say than you have. You're a member of the group. You do your 12-step work.
We do it together or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need my approval, goddammit. As long as you're living by the steps and living by the traditions,
mm-hmm.
you don't need nobody's approval. I'm the same way, yeah, you know, mm-hmm. and I still say the same thing. You don't need anybody's approval to do anything when it comes to helping yourself.
That's right.
And helping a newcomer.
Sure.
You do whatever you can to help them, mm-hmm. you know. If all you can do is say, hello, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
Hang around, this is a good meeting place. Says, keep coming back, whatever.
Yeah.
That's all you can do. That's good enough.
That's right.
Know?
Like old Maury, you know?
Yeah.
Keep coming back.
Good enough.
Yeah.
So, so anyway, they're keeping on my goddamn...
53?
They're keeping right on my goddamn ass, and I'm getting tired.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm making the coffee, and I turn around. Eddie and Gil walk in, Gil's wife, you know. I turn around, Pat Hand walks in with another guy from Burbank he used to hang around with. I turn around, and Jesse Lawyer and his brother Manuel walk in from the east side, you know. And the first thing you know...
Manuel Lawyer, is that the guy they call Pancho?
No, that's another one. This is another lawyer.
Yeah.
And so I look, and I think, shit, this is the opportunity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I finish my coffee, and I put the lid on, and I walk around. And I introduced them to each other. Some of them didn't know each other,
mm-hmm.
you know. And Eddie knew most of them, but not all of them. He didn't know Pat Hand, didn't know the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Gil didn't know them, but they knew. Gil knew the lawyers, but didn't know the others.
Mm-hmm.
So I introduced them all
mm-hmm.
around, you know. And finally, Gus said, come here. Get, all get our heads together. So we mm-hmm. stood right near by the fireplace, you know, got our
mm-hmm.
heads together. Said, no, you son of a bitches, will you leave me alone and go start the goddamn meeting that you're talking about for addicts?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Go do it.
Yeah.
You know? So they jumped, you know. Mm-hmm. And so Gil says, well, I just rented a place over on, and right near Van Nuys Boulevard, I got a great big living room. He said, we can have a meeting there.
That's right.
The rest of them said, well, we have it. Will you come? I said, mm-hmm. sure, I'll come,
yeah.
you know.
Was that right on the corner of San Fernando Luver. Road? And
Luver and
Luver.
San Fernando Road. I got it on tape.
Yeah.
It's a dump site now. I mean, they have dump trucks going in and out of there now.
Oh, is that right?
Trash, you know?
Yeah.
That's like their garage and their office.
Yeah. Because I went to school with his daughter right about that time, too.
That.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I'd been over to his house
well,
in 1953.
Remember the big living room they had?
Big living room, and then he had his train tracks and everything set up
right.
in the garage.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right in the garage.
Yeah.
And then in the back was the bedroom.
Uh-huh.
Know? And so...
Yeah, I didn't know he was involved, but I knew that
so
he liked him a
this
lot.
This was not an A.
No.
This was not an A.
Uh-huh.
And they said to me, what should we call it? I said, I don't give a goddamn what you call it. The only name I know that might fit would be Narcotics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of us are narcotic users.
Mm-hmm.
And this makes sense to me. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, sounds good. But
so that was in
that
like
was
February or so of February or March?
52.
52.
So we go over the next Monday, and some of the other people, Maury showed up that night, and a couple of the other people
mm-hmm.
showed up from AA to, be,
mm-hmm.
to help, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we go over there, the very first meeting, Gil gets up and announces that he was going to call it HFD. Now, HFD goes back further than that. He was not the one to start that. I went back to Betty and Larry Town. I got acquainted with, this was another of some of the addicts I got acquainted with in the years that I started.
Uh-huh.
They were around AA and had been there about a year or so before I was. I think at least Betty was, but I don't think Larry was.
Uh-huh.
But that's beside the point. We were both on the program.
Uh-huh.
And I got to know Betty because she told the story that she had been one of the addicts who came into AA, you know, and she said she never had any problem with drinking, you know.
Uh-huh.
But she thought the program might help her, you know, the attitude that we
yeah.
have sometimes
sure.
towards programs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And about a year later, she decided, I think it was a party or New Year's or something, mm-hmm. decided she could have a drink. Why not?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And she said she was in worse shape at the end of 1 week on booze than she ever was on her.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Really
got caught her.
Yeah.
Pooey. You know?
Quick. Uh-huh.
That really just developed, right? Full blown. You know, she'd been drinking a little beer and a little
yeah.
highball here.
Yeah.
Here.
But she always had
last
drugs.
Year
yeah.
and thinking she was on the program, you know?
Yeah.
So she started what she called HFD, Habit Forming Drugs,
uh-huh.
and they had a little meeting in their apartment down in Santa Monica, but before you could get in the door of their meeting, you had to admit you were an alcoholic as well as an addict.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, most addicts were not going to do that. That's why in our little white book it says some people had tried other methods.
Uh-huh.
That's where that came from.
You love that stuff in that book. It's fundamental from what was happening and going on.
At that particular time.
Yeah. And so, Gil, I had told Gil now about Larry and Betty, and I had invited them to be my speaker on a Sunday night, my very first Sunday night meeting at the club that I ever led.
Uh-huh.
I asked them to be my speakers. Well, after they spoke, nobody in the clubhouse would talk to me.
It was all drugs.
I had no right to bring these people into AA. So I learned very early what it meant to be rejected and put down, you know. And sometimes that, I guess, is the reason why I get hot under the collar when I see it happening to other people, you know.
Yeah.
And there was no reason for it. These people were trying at that time to do a job, and then later on, of course, I met Doc Stewart a little bit later on, which is another part of the story.
David Stewart wrote the book, Thirst for Freedom?
Yeah, but then he and I had so many things that we thought very much alike on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason we got along as well as we did.
Yeah. Didn't his wife come to the program for a while?
She came down, if you remember. She used to come over for about 3 weeks, I think. She was down in town. She doesn't know how she got in town.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave used to tell her to try to find Narcotics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And I shouldn't have put his name on there, but that's the way it is, you know. Mm-hmm. I bleeped that out.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is more or less for our own...
That's right. It's not going to go any place anyway. No.
It's for our outlines.
Mm-hmm.
And so she came down and she arrived here in L.A. And somewhere or another, she called me, I think, or I got a hold of her through somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over to Sherry's place in Hollywood, remember? Did you ever come over to that meeting on Cahuenga? Sandy's place. Remember Sandy? Little Sandy?
No.
Maybe you don't remember Sandy.
No, I don't think so.
Well... Or was that before? I can't remember just what year that was.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she's never used or drank since.
Is that right?
Every once in a while, she sends me a card up until the last couple of years.
They've
split up for years.
Oh, yeah. Huh?
He's remarried.
Uh-huh.
And I think he's up in, I think he's up someplace in Santa Barbara again.
Oh.
I'm trying to find him.
Uh-huh.
Bill from Las Vegas called me. He moved down to Santa Barbara, and he's looking for him, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him to try the state hospital up there, that maybe he went back to work at state hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I first knew him.
Yeah.
I used to go up to Santa Barbara and see him.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, then what happened was that we started that. Gil got up and said this was going to be an HFD group, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I figured, oh, shit, here we go again, you know.
Oh, boy. Big kind of
domineering. You're going to do it this way. You're going to do it that way. A hot seat type of group,
mm-hmm.
you know. And this is, of course, long before Synanon, but that's the type of things that were germinating at the time. Well, I'll go along for a while and see what the hell happens. You know, I'll go.
Uh-huh.
So we get home, and there's another girl who had gone to that meeting, and she called me up right after that. And she'd be another one who had not been at the clubhouse that night with her husband. She was not a member of AA. She was strictly a fillhead, never drank. She was not a drinker. He was on the program, and so she calls me up, and she was so hot. Oh, that's like to burn up the wires in the kitchen. She was so hot. She was like, who the hell do they think they are? We're talking about trying. She said, you and I have talked so much about trying to get a group going to help addicts, and they come up with this stuff again. And, you know, that ain't working. People
mm-hmm.
won't go down there to those other meetings.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I'm not going to go in there and admit that I'm an alcoholic. Well, I try to talk to her like we talk to people.
Yeah.
Well, alcohol is just another goddamn
drug. Yeah.
You haven't used every drug in the market, have you?
Yeah.
She said, no. So you haven't used
You're
that
gonna
alcohol.
You're going to run experiment with
Yeah, I'm no, I ain't going to admit I'm an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But she's another hardhead, you know. So I said, well, I don't know what the hell we're going to do then.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm getting sick and tired of all this crap already, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be a big shot, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, that ain't why I'm here. I said, mm-hmm. I learned that very quickly. I learned that from Maury.
Mm-hmm.
I said, let the big shots go up and do all the talking. If you're called on, and you feel like doing it, yeah, go do it. And
mm-hmm.
he said, if you don't feel like doing it, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it is. And that's why I'm glad that Maury told me that. That's why I learned that you don't have to say yes all the time.
That's right, yeah.
See? You gotta take care of your number one.
Funny thing. How those little things are
so
important.
So that was very important for me, especially after I had gotten acquainted with Cy
mm-hmm.
and saw the way Cy was going, his ego. Which is,
mm-hmm.
And Maury used to tell me, he says, Cy's a sick man. And,
uh-huh.
He's a good man. He works. He's a hard worker.
Uh-huh.
But so anyway, she called me up again and again and again. Finally, she said, "We just got to get something going, sir. You know, I'm not going to go back to that meeting, and I need some kind of proof, you know." I said, "Okay." I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. Let me talk to a few people, see if they'd be willing to sit down with us and try to get something going, you know."
Mm-hmm.
So I went to quite a number of people. I'm not going to enumerate all their names.
Mm-hmm.
But all I got from them was no, 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 all the way down the line. Some of the people that you and I know well, and I've known well, and still know well today, no, 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 no.
Mm-hmm.
I told them some of the things that she and I had talked over. I said, "We've got to, fundamentally, we've got to do it right from the start. We've got to. I've learned this in AOA. If you don't live by the traditions, mm-hmm. you're not going to make it. I don't care what kind of group it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have traditions to guide you, mm-hmm. you're not going to make it,
mm-hmm.
you know." And she said, "Well, I don't know nothing about traditions, you know." She said, "All I want to do is get a group where I can go and where heights like I can go
mm-hmm.
and get some help."
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay, so I called a lot of people, and all I got to say was no. And finally, I got down to a couple of people that said, yeah, they'd come. Pat said he'd come. Little Paul said he'd come.
Paul Rosenbluth?
Yeah. Tommy said, "I'm going to do whatever I can, but I don't want to get into the group, you know." It's okay. Frank, that's all right.
Who was that?
Frank Carnahan.
Oh.
I said, "Frank, that's okay. You can give us whatever, you know, maybe help us get rolling, you know." So the very first meeting, it wound up, oh, God, it was a riot. See, everybody was fighting with each other. Shit, you know. Within 2 weeks, we had, I think we only had one or two people left of the original group, you know.
When was this about?
This was around the end of June or beginning of July in 1953.
Oh, yeah.
And so I replaced them with somebody else, replaced some of them with alcoholics who were unwilling, but thought, well, I'll try. Mm-hmm. One guy in particular, who came for, I think, for two meetings and finally quit,
mm-hmm.
turned out about 7 years later, 7 or 8 years later, after we had died out and came back again,
mm-hmm.
he showed up at a meeting one night.
Mm-hmm.
He'd gotten on the pills, and he was a full-fledged addict by then, see?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you see, you can never tell how it happens, how things happen.
That's
you
know? Right. So did we call Narcotics Anonymous?
We couldn't keep a group together hardly.
Mm-hmm.
But as each one came in, we got a little further. We got a little bit more stuff on paper, like
uh-huh.
like you see in that sheet that we had, you know, from the early days,
yeah.
the minutes, you
uh-huh.
know. And then we finally got it set up. So, okay. So we got the hall. We got the hall.
What hall was that?
That's the dad's hall.
The dad's hall.
The church, you know.
Over
we
in
got the hall.
Where was that?
Sun Valley.
In Sun Valley.
In Sun Valley, up on Araminta.
Uh-huh.
And not Araminta, I make that mistake all the time. God damn it. I make that mistake. I've had that in my mind so much,
for
I
years.
Cannot knock it out.
Huh.
You know?
Isn't that something?
Antara is the name
Antara. Antara. Is that the dad's club still there?
No. It's a Spanish church now.
Mm-hmm.
I have all this on tape. I've got all this on videotape.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a lot more to do, but I'm going out taking places that are still standing.
Oh, you're doing that on video.
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat, Jim.
See, that's going to be, that's what I'm really working on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Later on, maybe I can get it cleaned up and get it in tape, and maybe I can sell and make a couple of bucks to help me get along too, like
sure.
anybody else.
Sure. Darn right.
Why not? You know.
Yeah.
And especially the early days.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, what happens is we got enough people. We got four people that were willing to stick together long enough. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So as it says in that little the minutes, you know, mm-hmm. elected me the first chairman. You know. The mm-hmm. first thing I said to him was, "You've got to have a name for this thing." So, is there any suggestions?
Mm-hmm.
So, different ones brought up different. Well, nobody wanted to talk. That's I said, "Well, I've suggested Narcotics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've been talking about for a while. It's an anonymous program, and that tells people we're anonymous. It mm-hmm. lets them know that they don't have to worry.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main reason I want this, you know."
Mm-hmm.
Or I said, "We could call it Naranon." Mm-hmm. Which would be the same thing, Narcotics Anonymous,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could call it Narcanon. And I'm sorry I didn't tie up all those names years ago, but I didn't know how to do that
mm-hmm.
in those days. So then Narcanon wouldn't have been able to use that name.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And, of course, Naranon I suggested to
Alma.
When she and I sat down together to talk about forming the group, she said, "What should we call it?" I said, I told her what I'm telling you. We had five different names that we chose. One was Narco, that we threw that out right away. No, then Narcanon, Naranon, and she said, I like the sound of that, Naranon. Non-addict, you know. Narcotics Anonymous, good for you guys, and Naranon, we are not addicts, you know.
And
she said, it sounds like Al-Anon, you know. And so that's where that came from, that name. So, anyway, they finally said, no, they don't like any of them. And what they're going to do is they're going to call it N-A-A-A or A-A-N-A. One or the other, so you can't do that.
Well, call it both combination,
you
huh?
You cannot do that, you know. Well, that's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. So the very first thing I suggested, they knocked me down, right?
Yeah.
See? They didn't want. They voted me down. So I said, well, okay, in that case, then I suggest... But you, since you're the secretary, you've been made secretary of a group that you call New York and talk to somebody in AA in New York and you ask them point blank if you can do that.
Uh-huh, yeah.
The next week she did. When they came back the next week,
no way.
Some more, she said, no, we can't use that. That's what I told you, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, but that's all right. The second thing I suggested, I can't remember what the hell it was right offhand now. I suggested something else anyway. And they voted me down, too, on that. They said, we were off to a good start, you know.
Yes.
Asked about what we've been ever since.
Sure.
And, but then eventually we got it together, and there's a couple of other people fell off, and but these four stuck pretty well. Up to the point where we were all ready to have the first meeting. All right, we had the first meeting, and, you know, there's a list of the people who came there. About half of them were alcoholics, and the other half... Some of them never came back, but some of them have come back since, you know, as full-fledged addicts.
Yeah.
So that's about what the story was. There was a touching, hidden, touching road situation all the time, you know. I got a speaker for Gilda that I knew in AA, because that was the only source we had for people at any time, you know.
Sure.
Who was an addict, and at the last minute... And this is the important part of the story. At the last minute, he called me up and he said, Jimmy, I just got a call. I've got to go to New York.
Who was this?
I'm trying to remember his name. He eventually married one of the girls who was at the first meeting. Remember the Panzer sister?
Joanne. Buddy Panzer?
He eventually married Joanne. His name was...
Yeah, I went to high school with them.
Yeah, what the hell was his name? Shit, I can't remember his name. He's a movie actor, stage... He was out of here. He's got size to it. His name seems to be coming through. It'll come through me, but I can't recall it right now. He said, I got to go to New York and open in a play on Broadway, off Broadway. And he said, I can't turn it down. And he said, I got to leave now. He says, I won't be able to make it Monday night. Now, this was like Thursday night.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, okay. No.
So the meetings started on a Monday night.
Monday night. Uh-huh. I said, okay. I said, I'll see if I can get somebody else. So I got to think, who the hell else can I get? So I knew new Cy's attitude, you know, and I thought, well, shit. Cy takes his wife on Friday nights over to the women's meeting. He takes Ozzy over there on Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gently waits around, you know, outside until the meeting's over.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured I'd go over and talk to Cy. So I go over there, and sure enough, he drops his wife off, and I said, Cy, can I talk to you? Sure. And we started talking. I tell him what's going on. And he's one of the guys who turned me down. I asked him if he wanted to be on the board. You know?
Oh, yeah.
No, let them find their own way. You know, let them find their own way. And which in a way, I'm glad now. This is why I have such adamant attitudes in separating the two fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm so strong, I think. Because I've seen some of the things that have happened. You know?
Yeah.
And I didn't know what the hell else to say. And just kept saying, no, I can't. I don't want to go and talk to those people. No, I'm not. I'm a medical addict, you know. I got hurt in the service, and I got into the pills through the Veterans Administration, you know. And I'm not a street addict or anything like that, you know, although he changed the story so many times later on. And I'm not saying this because I have it in black and white.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I listened to radio one time about a year after this, and I listened to him on the radio in the morning where he broke his anonymity and said he founded NA. You know, I listened to him. I'm sorry, I don't have a tape.
Uh-huh.
And I tackled him about it, so I just got carried away. Well, he got carried away.
Yeah, yeah.
And not that it was that important, you know, but the fact you come out and give your name
uh-huh.
on radio in the morning, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he'd been around the program a couple of years longer than I had in AA.
Yeah,
and he knew, you know.
The tradition.
But, you know, some of them, that's why I'm so careful if I go on radio or anything public mm-hmm. like that, that I don't give a goddamn who knows me, you know. As long as
yeah.
I don't break the traditions. Mm-hmm. If I break them accidentally, okay, that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, brings me to another thing about accidentally breaking your anonymity. I'm going to have to look through a lot of my old tapes to see if I can find the one where Mary Jane and Jean broke their anonymity. If you remember, it was on that show. Remember all the hell broke loose one time?
Oh, on the radio
yeah.
program? That's
I
right.
On the TV program.
Oh, it was TV?
And just lucky, I had my tape on.
Uh-huh.
I was going to tape another guy who was supposed to be on that show, and they came on, and I had the tape on.
And you didn't even realize it was
on
there. That's right, I remember.
So they called me.
Well, I think pretty well you can get the idea. The fact that Narcotics Anonymous started it all is really the miracle of the program. Jimmy goes on and talks about it, and Cy was, once they got the meeting started and going in July through October of 1953, it wasn't Jimmy so much that kept the meeting going, although Jimmy insisted on going every Monday night and showing up at the meeting. But sooner or later, Cy became the more dominant personality in the fellowship at that time, which was one meeting. And pretty soon they got the idea of, rather than meeting at this church, what they really needed to do was move the meeting. And they moved the meeting into a place called Shire's Dryer, which was an alcohol detox center in Los Angeles, and took the meeting there. And the meeting went there for about the next 3 years. And it was at that time that, even though Jimmy showed up and Jimmy would bring newcomers to this meeting, because it was the only game in town, really, for someone who had a drug problem and couldn't talk about it in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, it was the only game in town. So when Jimmy came across a newcomer, he would take them there. And for the next 3 years, they survived in this place called Shire's Dryer. And the problem that Jimmy had was the fact that the doctor who ran the detox center was paying for everything for the group. And along about 1959, one of the guys who was continuing to go to the meetings finally came up to Jimmy and said, "We're done. You know, we can no longer do it. I have to go on a trip somewhere. I can't do it. Here's the records of the meeting. Here's the $20 we have in the bank account that we don't know where it is, but handed him over $20 and said, that's it. We're done." And for the next few months, NA didn't exist. And a few of the folks that had come together and come to those early meetings finally said, what we need to do. And there was this one woman in particular. Her name was Sylvia W. And she came to Jimmy and begged him, "We have to start this thing over again. You know, I could never stand those meetings that were run by in one-man rule. We have to start this thing right." And that really was the place where Narcotics Anonymous, as we know it today, began. And it began in 1960. And through this, what they did this time differently was they began to write things. And Jimmy sat down and began to write things like recovery and relapse, and some of the things, what is NA, how does it work in its earliest form. And what this symbolizes in this frame is all of the white books, starting from the very first one that was written in about 1957 by the group that was meeting in Shire's Dryer. Jimmy helped out a little bit, Cy helped out, and a gentleman named Jack P., who was working with the Institutional Committee in Southern California with AA, actually put that first little brown folder together. And then as you move on and you see the next two brown ones, there was a a meeting mentioned in San Diego, but we haven't been able to find out too much about it. But up to 1960, those brown folders were the only things that people who were coming to Narcotics Anonymous had, were those two things. And they asked you 20 questions. And if you go outside where we have the archives set up and you pick up one of the notebooks, you can look inside and see what those 20 questions are, because there's reprints of every one of these out there in a little notebook. So if you have some time during the convention, please stop by. And if you look over here and you see the first long white book, that became the Narcotics Anonymous little white book, the very first one. And that was the one that Sylvia and Jimmy and several other members of Narcotics Anonymous at that time sat down and actually wrote. The next thing they really tried to do to try and make sure that the fellowship would not die again was insist on writing bylaws. We probably wouldn't write bylaws for our groups today, but then it was important. It became like how you run your group. And since it was the only group at the time, they call them the bylaws. And the bylaws actually sat down and spoke about how to run a meeting. They set up, this is what the leader does, this is what they do, this is what we read in our meeting. And it really was the first thing that we can directly relate to as Narcotics Anonymous today, because those meetings were much like the meetings that you and I go to. And over the years, some of the language may have changed, and some of the things that they talked about may have changed, but that idea of a meeting, of sitting down and talking about recovery and talking together as members of a fellowship, happened in the early 60s. And we know some people like Bob Barrett came in about that time. Some of the people that had walked away from Narcotics Anonymous meetings in the 50s now began to show up again. Pepe A. from California is another one. And they really became a small group of folks really working to try and make the fellowship work. They tried to a lot of different things. And one of the things that they tried was they tried to set out a public relations plan, which they were met with little success. But at that time, really, you know, there were no treatment centers. The general population did not think that addicts could be helped. There was no recovery for addicts. In fact, the main saying back at that time is once an addict, always an addict. And if you read Jimmy's story in We Do Recover, he remembered that well. And part of what they were trying to do, and they did little by little, but mostly in Southern California, was to try and get over to people that addicts could recover. Because by the mid-1960s, Jimmy now had about 15 years clean. And there were a couple of people that had 3, 4, and 5 years clean. But they had a hell of a job to do, and really not many resources to do it. But they hung together. Along about that time, there was a group of folks called the Magdaleno family. They came in, Sylvia Magdaleno, who eventually moved up to Northern California. And when she and her brothers moved up to Northern California, they took NA with them. And really what they did, and if you look out in the archives, you'll see these books called the Ad Center. Well, that was the first treatment center ever to use the concept of addicts helping addicts. That was a whole new concept that had not previously existed. If you went to treatment before then, what you usually ran into was your typical group of professionals who were trying to help us poor people get better. And even though some of them did succeed, they certainly did not meet with the type of success that we've seen today. And actually began back in the mid-1960s. And it was really our first run-in with trying to deal with an outside agency who also had the same goals and aims that we did, and that was to try and help people. So it became a big issue in the fellowship in the early 1960s about this treatment center in Northern California using Narcotics Anonymous material out of the little white booklet in their pamphlet. And it was the first big issue, but they were able to develop it. And also, Narcotics Anonymous is full of, how should I put this? As you heard Jimmy talk about, he and Cy hit loggerheads. And sooner or later, it became the San Fernando Valley versus the west side of Los Angeles. You know, there's always those people. And we've always had that throughout our history. We've always found somebody to kind of, you know, fight with. And later on, it became Northern California and Southern California. You know, they wanted to do it differently, and they thought they had better ideas. And even as we move on into the late 60s, early 70s, you know, Northern California wrote their own piece of literature. And pretty soon, there were some good fights going on. But all of that stuff got put aside. You know, because the real job that these people have, and what I try to get over to people in talking about history, because most of us, when we went to school, history class came and it was nap time, okay? It was time to kind of think of everything else we could be doing, like getting high and shit. So, but history gives us a sense about where we came from. And history is important because there's a saying that I'm sure we've all heard, that those who forget about the past are doomed to repeat it. And this is true. And one of the reasons why it's important that we bring the history of the fellowship out, so that we can all learn as a fellowship from the mistakes and the successes of our predecessors. Well, back in those early days, there weren't many people who wrote. There weren't many people who kept records. There wasn't the type of technology that you and I can take advantage of today to do things. As you heard Jimmy talking with Gene, you know, they got a tape recorder. It was like the newest, fanciest thing out there, you know, an old Wallensack. Well, I have that old Wallensack, and it really is something that you would put in an antique shop, you know. But it still works. So anyway, and going into the 1970s, there was a terrific amount of work to do. And up to this time, you got to realize that Narcotics Anonymous had very little support from the society that we existed in. We had had up to that time some contact with Australia. We had talked to people in the early 70s in other countries. I found some letters to Brazil from that time in the archive. But it mostly centered on Southern California. And I know what I'm really grateful for in going back and reading these things is the fact that these people were not selfish. That although they had their jobs and they had a great deal of work to do there locally in California, they insisted on taking the message as far as it could be taken. And during the early 70s, the World Service Office existed during certain months of the year, and the next 3 months they'd have to close down because they didn't have money. Bob Barrett used to run around with a WSO in the trunk of his car. It was really kind of a loose group of folks who had this common focus, but they didn't have any money and they didn't have any support. Really all they had was each other. You know, and they tried to keep the fellowship going because they believed in it so much. And I'm grateful they did. Because if they had taken that internal look, I wouldn't be here today. So I was glad that somebody happened to show up at a place where I was at with a little white book. So back in the late 60s, early 70s, Narcotics Anonymous exists primarily in California. And little by little, as you move on through the early 70s, things start to happen. Greg P. came in and got involved. And he was more of an organizer type of guy, and he could kind of help Jimmy and the other guys kind of organize things a little bit, you know. And Greg had a talent to write, you know. And he had an idea about creating a service structure or creating something, a service something to help the groups locally. And he really helped them do that. And they started looking at putting together an organization that would help the groups locally there in Southern California and in Northern California. So beginning in the 1970s, we started to see a proliferation of some organization in California. And little by little, those little white books kind of snuck across the country. And people have great stories about how somebody showed up, thank you, Steve, showed up at their meeting with a little white booklet. And little by little, beginning at that time, you started to get information from Pennsylvania, you know. You may only get one letter from those folks and never hear from them again, but you got something. You know, something started to happen outside of California. Meanwhile, they had sat down and they made some adjustments to the little white booklet, changed some of the language in it, added stories to the little white booklet, and began to create other things besides the little white booklet. Some of the pamphlets they created at that time was Recovery and Relapse. They also made two or three pamphlets at that time that were direct adaptations from Alcoholics Anonymous. One was called We Made a Decision. And it was a pamphlet that we still had in the early 80s until somebody said, well, you know, AA said, you know, you guys can't do this anymore. So they tried to create literature because even though they couldn't go to these places, the literature could. And the literature could help carry the message of Narcotics Anonymous across the country and even across the world. So the 1970s, and getting into the mid-1970s, there was this explosive growth. Society had begun to realize that there was a possibility that you could help drug addicts. And little by little, treatment centers began to spring up. Not only the one in Berkeley, but treatment centers in Southern California and treatment centers in Pennsylvania. Who took these initial ideas that were developed in the places like the Ad Center, places like Impact, places like Cry Health that still exists in Southern California today, and began to share that with other professionals. And pretty soon you saw treatment centers begin to blossom. And we also got better at communicating. Things started to get better, and the communication started to improve. Not only were people writing letters, people began to telephone. And there happened to be an address and a telephone number that people could send things to. So by the mid-1970s, things started to get a little more stable for the fellowship. People started to stay clean. People started to go only to Narcotics Anonymous. Now, this wasn't true for everyone. Because in the beginning of 1970, there was about 20 meetings worldwide. That was our fellowship. And beginning in 1980, there were 2,000 meetings. So the fellowship in the 70s just really started to grow. And people really started to carry the message. And people who got clean in California began to move. Imagine that at its beginning to move. You should see how we try and keep up with you guys at the World Service Office. So you really have this new fellowship who took its basic foundation developed in the 60s and now is beginning to blossom. And things were happening, you know. Intergroups were starting in Pennsylvania, area service committee. Jimmy and Greg sat down and wrote DNA Tree, which was our first service manual, which to them at that time in 1975 was light years ahead of its time. The fellowship, that they say in the very beginning, that we know the fellowship is not to this point yet, but this is how we believe the fellowship needs to grow and prosper. And they called something called the World Service Conference. Well, the World Service Conference met the first time in 1976. Now, beginning in 1971, Narcotics Anonymous started to put on what they called NA conventions. Also, and at that first World Convention in 1971 in La Mirada, not La Mirada. In 1971, there was about 200 people. that showed up at that convention. And if you go out into the archives cabinet, you can see the program from that first convention. They had a convention, the second convention was in North Hollywood, and so on and so on. So that's how the conventions got such large numbers, because they began in 71. So in 19, along those times, not only did they want to put on a convention, but they also wanted some type of service conference. And they tried to combine the two. And in 1976, they had a convention in Ventura, California, and a conference. Now, I believe the record shows that there was 14 people who showed up to that first convention conference. And they were all from California. But this was the World Service Conference. And they talked about big ideas and dreams and things about how they wanted to help this fellowship grow. And they made some big plans. They were only missing one thing, really. They had the desire, they had the members who were willing to do the work, but there really existed no money. Whatever Narcotics Anonymous money we had at that time usually got spent on the area level or on the group level, and there were no large sales of literature. Whatever Jimmy used to send out packets of literature all over the place, and people either sent their check in or they didn't, you know. And sometimes you got paid for that literature, sometimes you didn't. But he believed in taking that risk. So he sent out a lot of literature, but there wasn't any money to do all these things that members felt that they needed to do. And as you get in and you start to see how this fellowship begins to get organized, beginning in 77, you know, more groups started to pop up in Pennsylvania. Even as far back as 1978, we have letters from Louisiana, meetings starting in New Orleans. Other places, Georgia, Florida, Ohio, all of these places started Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and most of them started in two ways. Either a member called up the World Service office because he heard about it somewhere. Now, most people talk about Narcotics Anonymous under their breath at that time. You know, when you talked about Narcotics Anonymous, it wasn't something she took out into the general public. You know, you kind of whispered Narcotics Anonymous. Or members moved from Southern California out to different parts of the country. But it was the beginning of what has been a 20-year growth spurt for us. You know, society finally opened up. We started to finally get organized. Little by little, we started to bring some money to pay for some of the services that we were doing. We were getting together on an annual basis, both to talk about service and to talk about recovery at the World Convention. So the fellowship started to grow. And in 1977, I believe, it was the first World Convention outside the state of California. It was held in Houston, Texas. Well, it took about 11 or 12 more years before we ever let California have that convention back. Because from then on, it went to other places. And every place that World Convention went, Narcotics Anonymous started to grow. And the convention was really something that helped us grow from the west to the east. And we started to see that there was a need for more literature. And we started to get information from countries outside of the United States. And we started to see that eventually that there was going to be a need for Narcotics Anonymous literature to be translated. And they started thinking about that. Along about 1978, we have our first versions of Spanish, the Spanish White Book. We have our first version of German. And we also have a version of Polish that many people didn't know about. Some members in Poland had written Jimmy and said we wanted to start a meeting. And what Jimmy did was he'd go over to the university and get somebody there to translate it. Well, we know today that many of those translations were just not usable because they were done by people who really didn't know and understand what the program was. but it was the beginning of really, Jimmy always had a dream. And the other people who came in, like Greg and other people after that, shared that dream, you know, that one day, you know, every addict would have the opportunity to get this thing called Narcotics Anonymous. Along about this time, there had been rumors of the fact that one day Narcotics Anonymous is going to write a book. We're going to write a book, and it's going to be better than that AA Big Book, and it's going to be for addicts. Well, they had been talking about this for about 10 years, and they really had the desire to do it. Well, and I believe it was in 1977, a gentleman showed up at the World Convention, or the World Service Conference, and started asking about this book. Wanted to know who was writing it. And he got shoved over to this person and that person, and finally he got to Jimmy and asked him about it, and he got shoved over to Greg. And that was the beginning of what would come 5 years later, the Narcotics Anonymous Basic Text. What that book did and what that movement did for this fellowship is evident here today. Bo was a terrific organizer and somebody who really believed in going out and getting the fellowship involved, and that's exactly what he did. Up to that time, people at the World Service Office were seen as them. And when he came along, he kind of took this responsibility on himself, went back to Georgia, and said, "We got to do this." And pretty soon, they started doing it. You know, and literature workshops began to prosper, went around the country. They worked feverishly on this book. Drafts got sent out. Letters got sent out to the fellowship. They got their own list of things. And anybody who even mentioned that they may be in Narcotics Anonymous, I think he ended up with something and got a letter, "Please get involved." Well, really what was happening at this time was another tumultuous change in our fellowship. You know, I likened it, and I think other people have likened it at the time, was there was a range war going on in NA. You know, it was all about us and them. Because when Bo started his movement, many of the people thought that that should be really what Jimmy did. And there started to be this friction between the WSO and this World Literature Committee movement. Because these folks in California, although they had been pretty willing to give up this fellowship, really believed that they deserved the honor of getting this book going. And I'm sure what Bo thought was, "All right, you guys had 10 years. Okay, it's time to get it going." But there became such a rift in the fellowship. Controversy, and I think the controversy actually helped us grow. There are a few people in this room that were there, and I happened to bebop into Narcotics Anonymous in about 1980 in Miami. And there was a little guy, there was a guy who came to the meeting and read out of this little white book, and it was the only piece of literature that anybody had. And we used to have to swear that we would show up with that white book the next week, you know, so we could take it home. And I remember looking in there, and I saw this address, and I wrote to the World Service Office, and 16 weeks later, my literature arrived. I didn't want to tell anybody. So I read everything and went to the meetings and shared these wonderful things out of literature. And eventually had to give it up. Everybody found out what my source was. So anyway, that's all of the outposts of Narcotics Anonymous, I'm sure, went through the same thing. The struggle to get the meetings going, the struggle to get information. You know, I thought Narcotics Anonymous and World Services was a group of 12 men who lived in a temple somewhere in Southern California and wore white and spoke very spiritually. And that was just my idea, you know. And I think other people shared this maybe in a different form, but, you know, I wanted so much to get near people who had recovery, you know, and I got involved in service. And my service landed me in Southern California in 1981, so I was in Mecca, you know. And Mecca was going on in two places. The conference was going on in the valley, and there was also this literature writing thing going on in Santa Monica. And we'd go back and forth, back and forth. And it was just great to see all this energy being put to use. And then we get into the argument, you know, people arguing. Not so much about who was right or wrong, but everybody had this love for this fellowship that they wanted to see these things become a success. But it was a very difficult time for us, you know. People were taking sides. People were probably doing some things that we shouldn't. But we were very young, you know. A lot of the people who showed up at the World Service conferences in the early 1980s were people who were young in recovery and came from a young fellowship, you know, because somebody came along and told them that there was something happening, you know, and people got involved because we really believed at that time that we had a responsibility. We all had a responsibility to try and carry this message. And despite all these wars and despite all of these things going on and some of the hateful letters going back and forth, we approved the book. We approved a better service structure. We approved new pamphlets. We saw the fellowship go from 2,000 groups in 1980 that by 1986 we had over 7,000 groups of Narcotics Anonymous meeting on a weekly basis. There are so many stories to tell about our history. And really what we're trying to create is give our members a sense of where we came from and the idea that you can learn from your mistakes. Because today, really, from all of those early efforts, you know, I know in Southern California I'm very spoiled. Okay, because I can go to a meeting, and most meetings I go to, there's four or five people who have over 20 years. And that's just on a regular basis. So I'm very spoiled by that. But I remember getting clean in Miami, and an old-timer, anybody had a day more than you? And I think that realizing this and realizing the efforts and the struggles that we go through. And, of course, when I walked into the program, you see, I believe that nobody had written these things right, and the steps definitely needed to be revised. And I certainly could do it a lot better than those folks. But I didn't have the information of why they wrote the steps out this way. You know, why we have these steps, why we have these traditions. A lot of our problems in the early 80s was because nobody had taken the time to sit down and write about the principles and the experience our early members had with the tradition. And probably could have saved us a lot of shit. Don't you think that? A lot of shit. But that's the beauty of the history. You know, the beauty of this, the history of this fellowship is just rich in stories. And one day, hopefully, we can tell it all. And I'm going to stop here in the mid-1980s because really there's so many stories even beginning from the late 70s that need to be told that are not complete yet, you know, because many of these members are still involved. Many of these members are still around today. Now, I don't know about you, but history's kind of, in the history we have the early fellowship until we got the last archives, was kind of whose perception and memory was actually the truth. So we've had to go back and reconstruct things from very little information to find out really what happened. Well, what's really the beauty of how this fellowship has grown is, see, we not only have the members who in the late and mid-70s actually went through this terrific period of growth for our fellowship still around, we also have the word. We also have the record. And hopefully through our members becoming more involved in our history and members getting an appetite for our history, we can all learn. you know, that we don't have to make the same mistakes over and over again, that many of our predecessors have already tried those things, you know. And there's just so much story to tell. I have about 350 reel-to-reel tapes, and you can get an idea about how it was to listen to Jimmy. Jimmy could spin a story, you know. And they're all Jimmy, and they're all other members. I listened to a tape the other day of a meeting back in 1960 that Jimmy walked in and recorded. There's so many stories to tell about what happened and how members felt. It sounded like, except for the language, you know, from the 50s, you know, being hip and all that stuff, it was like being in a meeting today of Narcotics Anonymous. And that's what we need to share with each other. You know, those are the types of things that we need. I really hope, since this was the first time that we tried this type of thing, that we will evolve to where we can hold most people's attention, okay? Because I noticed, you know, the minute Jimmy went on, a bunch of people left. Because Jimmy wasn't exciting. You had to listen to him, and pretty soon he enwrapped you, you know, with the way that he talked. So hopefully, by showing you these materials and having these materials, and yes, I do have these books that were created last year that tell a story about Narcotics Anonymous and how we began, I hope that we can do this out in the fellowship, that you will give me feedback about maybe some things that we can do differently. But I hope that I have been able to help create an atmosphere that when you leave here today, you'll have a better sense about where you came from. And if I did that, then I've been successful. And I thank you very much.